We're back with the TV podcast recap of The Expanse Season 2. You know, we did a couple episodes, then we did a few more episodes, then we did a few more, and now it's just the last half of Season 2. We're going to cover it all. I'm Jason Snell, and I'm joined by these fine members of our Expanse viewing club. In a ship headed for unknown reaches of outer space, it's Tony Sindelar. Hello.
Hello, space friends.
Circling the mysterious planet Venus, it's Dan Morin.
Hi, Haas.
I don't know. He's on Earth and just wants to see the sun. It's Joe Rosensteel. Hello.
Hello.
And Aline, where would you like to be?
Not Ganymede.
Outside the radiation belts of Jupiter.
Yes, okay.
It's Aline Sims.
All right, here with my soybean plant.
Who knew botany was so important?
I did. I knew that.
Botanists? Maybe.
Phlebotomists? Something like that.
That's something different.
That's something totally different. Mm-hmm. Although they're both related. So The Expanse Season 2. It's funny. I feel like we actually did a pretty nice cut between the first and second half of the season, because the first half of the season, we have Miller. The second half of the season, we have Prax. Mm-hmm. Another guy with interesting hair / head things going on. In case of Prax, he gets to wear a nice wound for the whole half season. Verisimilitude in TV broadcasting. So we get to see Prax and more on Ganymede, and a bunch of other stuff happens. I don't know. What do we want to talk about here? Because, you know, it's a big thing to I don't think we can kind of go through every single episode, but thinking of the back half of the season and the season as a whole might be the best way to do it. So we got a lot of different threads going on here. Maybe let's take it by setting a little bit. What about Bobby and Avasarala, really? Because they're kind of connected in the second half. We get Bobby attacked, and she's given bad advice by people on Mars, and then she gets to go to Earth.
I feel like they set her up, her and Avasarala, much more. And again, you know, not to do too much, you know, comparison to the books, but I feel like they're set up to be a lot more adversarial here. And it kind of works in that, you know, we have them, their first meeting in the context of this supposed peace talks, but which all kind of seem like a sham, or, you know, sort of a cover for other activities. And so, you know, it really does a nice job of setting up why Bobby is very resistant to going against anything that the hierarchy has told her. But it also makes that eventual decision from her to, you know, defect, essentially, I feel like, far more powerful.
I hate that. I hate her Martian superior officer guy. I actually, when she finally hauls off and slugs him, I actually was thinking that would happen a scene earlier, because he just became so just increasingly hateful. That, because it really is like, you know, he's a jerk and the government is doing something questionable, and in the end she just can't take it anymore. But I guess it's good that they showed that she kind of was a loyal soldier up to the point where she realized that she was being set up and her superiors were not being honorable, and makes us feel better about her. But mm-hmm. he was mean and awful, which was enjoyable because I got to see her be all righteous.
Yeah, it was nice. A little weird though, because he was supposed to be like the chaplain of the ship, and then wasn't he just
I always assumed that was a lie.
And yeah, like he seemed like a
it's like Sucker kind of Red spy. October.
He's section
31 written all over him. Yeah.
Yeah, he just was someone that she had no interaction with prior to this, but was somehow best friends with the father, and was accompanying her down to the surface for this. It seemed so weird to have him hanging around the whole entire time, until you finally get the scene where it's like, oh yeah, I'm going to tell you all the secrets where I'm actually involved in everything before you punch me out completely. So that he was someone to keep an eye on, because I didn't really... He came out of nowhere, I think. He was one of the tweaks to things that was sort of interesting to watch.
Yeah, I did share the read that there was more to him than met the eye, that he was obviously a political officer, plant, spy type guy.
It is. It's kind of weird to me that we have the perspective on Earth and the belt from so many characters, and then we don't, like, kind of our main insight into people from Mars is somebody who is basically, I guess, would probably be considered now a traitor to Mars. So that is the kind of one kind of strange point in the storytelling, is there's not as much a sympathetic, I'm just caught up in the, right. the you know, the gears of war as Mars lurches toward war character from a political perspective.
Alex is similar, right? Like, he is an expat, right? We don't get, you're totally right. We don't get, like, the view of Mars from Mars. And that's kind of true in the books, too, up until a point.
Yeah. I mean, you really have to kind of look for it. There's some of the short stories that there's at least one about, like, a student on Mars and things like that. But yeah, it's, we don't worry about them so much. So, for whatever reason, it's a big galaxy. Not everybody gets a book. So.
Yeah, it's so far definitely about kind of the Earth belt perspective and not Mars at all. I gotta say, I still love Bobby. I think she's amazing. I love her. It's great.
I liked the whole way the show handled Martians coming to Earth, where, like, they've been planet side before because they've been on Mars, but they've never been to Earth where they could be out under the sky. And there could be, like, birds and things like that, and an ocean, and how they handle that first. There's, like, a POV shot where they're coming off the shuttle, and they want them to kind of, like, have their sunglasses on, and they just look down at the ground.
Yeah,
don't let Earth mess you up. And then, you know, she ends up breaking out and all of that. And I liked that feeling of, like, this is a human being who has never been to planet Earth before, and she's trying to, you know, what that experience would be like and how alienating it is. And I thought that was all really cool.
I liked that side plot with her trying to go find the ocean. I actually thought, like, because we haven't gotten a really good idea of what's going on Earth outside of, you know, sort of the highest corridors of power. And I feel like, you know, aside from a couple other scenes in there, right, because, like, we have, like, Holden's family very early on. But it's kind of interesting to get a different view of the city and of her, you know, we seeing it through Bobby's eyes gives us a very different perspective about what life on Earth is like, or what, and versus, like, what's expected to be like.
Yeah. And I also like that it's giving us insight into Bobby too. And it's showing her as a resilient, free thinking person, as opposed to someone who's been trained to be an on the ground soldier, right? She's not in a leadership position necessarily. And so we get that, I think, insight into how willful and resilient and determined she can be, and I really, really like that.
I thought it was the where she goes off and she interacts with the kind of street people of, I guess, New York area, was kind of important to see, because I don't know, we have all these depictions of kind of, like, how brutal and awful life is on the belt, and so there's always kind of the question of, like, why do people leave Earth if the only people we see on Earth live on, you know, rolling hills of horse farms and you know, and in the UN. So it is, like, showing that, like, yeah, a lot of people on Earth have pretty not so great lives.
Yeah, when he talked to the doctor and it was like, I'm still waiting for my placement, and it's not gonna happen.
Does anybody remember Dark City, the movie? I did have moments where I thought that Bobby's quest was like trying to get to Shell Beach in Dark City, where it's like, like, she's never going to get there.
I hope she doesn't jump in front of a train.
She's never going to go down that tunnel and finally get to the water, but she totally does, and there's, like, a drone there, and Avasarala comes, and it's there's a whole conversation that happens
I want to take a minute and discuss, I think it's Kotyar.
Yeah,
apparently this character does appear very briefly
Captain
in
Boomerang.
The books. Yes, he is Captain Boomerang from the Arrowverse as well. But I really like him here. He kind of grew on me from a character who seemed kind of inconsequential, and I think giving Avasarala, like, not quite a foil, but, like,
at least someone to talk to.
Yeah, a sidekick helps.
He's the only one who's on her team that we know is on her team, right?
Yes. And even that, like, they try to briefly play with that later on, like, his allegiances. And I think, you know, even though, you know, I think it's well done, because even though I don't think most of the audience believes he will turn on her, like there is like at least a brief sliver of doubt because everybody in this show seems to have shifting loyalties to a certain extent.
I was a little confused because I felt like he kind of transitioned from being like her underworld contact spy fixer character to I'm just hanging out in your office. Like, let me know, like, do you have anything that needs filed or like I'll carry your bags. I'm just here all the time.
They do make that a little weird, but I think that's part of that is because they realized having her just be her spy really limited his interactions. Mm-hmm. But I was really worried he was going to bite it at the end there.
Yeah, well, I mean, you get a chest wound. It's probably in the season or in the season finale.
Yeah,
it's usually a bad sign. But he seemed like he was going to make it at the end. Although, if I suppose if the actor doesn't please them, they can just say, "Oh, he died. He died on the way back to the show."
I think he does a good job, and I think that's probably. I wonder if he was intended to die there with Bobby basically taking up his role, and instead they decided, "Well, he's still kind of a fun character. Maybe we'll keep him around."
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a fun character. So what do people think of the that last little bit? I quite enjoyed it. The twist where we're left to believe that Aaron Wright is going to kill himself, and in fact, what he does is he kills the Martian envoy because he realizes and orders the Navy to blow up the ship that was coming to get the protomolecule information because he's going to seize the protomolecule, and he hands Avasarala and Bobby to Mr. Mao and basically says you can get rid of them and you're going to give me the protomolecule, and then we end up having that face off on the yacht. That was a whole like that was the climax of the season in many ways. This was the exciting like action piece, I think, that climaxed the season. What did you all think of that whole twist with Aaron Wright and the face off in the yacht?
Well, I thought it was an interesting play on things. I was trying to rack my brain because it's been, I don't know, 5 years, I guess, since I've read the second book. And while it may be my favorite in the series, I don't exactly remember the details.
I can't remember the details
they all bleed
at
together.
All.
I read them all back to back, so they're just like, it's just one long continuous story to me until very weird things happen, which the show may never get to.
But I thought it was something about how the motivations were Mao's still in that scene, but I could be confused. So I found it played well for tension. His little speech that he gave, since obviously they can't respond because of the time delay, I thought that worked well. Communicating that she needed to go back and get the Martian suit and bring it back over, and with the power armor, take care of stuff, but he needed to defend the position. It was like this is actually a reasonably good amount of tension, and cross-cutting that with what's happening on the Rocinante worked very well in a way that I feel like a lot of the action on the show up to maybe this point has not been as thrilling per se, you know, but yeah, it was nice to see that finally in action. Although I will say that slow motion Martian power armor does not work as well because you can see that it's just somebody in a rollerblading
suit.
Wanted actual sound effects and stuff in that scene.
Yeah, I think that would have really sold it.
Yeah,
because it just doesn't feel like there's any gravity, so to speak. For that, it's not as exciting.
Lee,
yeah, and I think that Aaron Wright comes across as a lot smarter and someone with a lot more.
Oh yeah.
I don't know, like agency in the show than he does in the books. In the books, he feels much more like a pawn, whereas on the show, he feels like a three-dimensional person, if that makes sense. And maybe that's just because we see him kind of more than we do in the books, I think. I like the scene a lot. I like the motivation. I like the kind of the back and forth between the crew and no, we really don't want to kill you, just, you know, whatever. And I don't know. I thought it was good. This is one of the scenes where I wish that the power armor, again, was what I thought it would be, the powerful, like, mech suit, basically, as opposed to just, like, you know, high-tech slimline armor.
It still looks a little too laser taggy, right?
Yeah, that's a good
way to put it. Hard to distinguish from like the vacuum suits that lots of people are wearing,
right?
Yeah,
yeah.
The Aaron Wright does he seems like an empty suit in the books is always how I read him. That Avasarala is the one who knows what's going on, and he's just the one with the position.
He's just there the one to essentially eventually be eliminated, right? It could feel like in some ways.
I feel like they somewhat kind of had for the earlier parts of this season and the previous season, where I thought it was very unclear, like who he is her boss, right?
Right.
But the way they depict them in meetings is not that dynamic, which didn't, I guess it just didn't seem intentional. It just seemed like, we're not really, like, we don't worry about that. But yeah, it does seem like basically he goes from, he is a pawn for a long time, and he, I don't know, I guess he kind of snaps, and he is trying to right the ship so that he doesn't have to just destroy his career.
But
and
now
and he's willing to burn everything down to make that happen. Yeah.
Only after he talks to his son from, with his like space hoverboard, whatever that he's, I thought that was a weird scene where it's like, yeah, this is totally what real life is. There's just like, we're in, you know, in the green lawns of UN whatever, and my son's got a space hoverboard, and I'm gonna just ruffle his hair on a park bench, and then I'm gonna go off and kill myself / start an interstellar incident, one of those to be determined.
That's how I feel.
Yeah, mood at the time. All right, what else should we cover? Should we cover the other thread, really, I guess, is the Rosinante, because we get Prax on Ganymede, and then they come to Ganymede, and lots of stuff happens there. So that's that, but that all kind of converges as well, as seasons tend to do at the end, right? Mm-hmm. Things converge. So we get Prax, who we meet mid-season, and he has a daughter who's going to a clinic, and Ganymede, as we saw with from Bobby's perspective, there's this kind of bombing, and the mirrors shatter, and the domes are destroyed or partially destroyed, and everything's a mess there.
I have to say, welcome Terry Chen as Prax, another of the Vancouver repertory players who you might remember from Continuum if you watch that series. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so we get Prax in a search for his daughter, which ends up leading him ultimately to the crew of the Rosinante, although by a roundabout means, where first off he's taken on a ship that spaces all the people who are not from not Belters,
all the
basically.
Inners. Yeah.
Yeah. That was a tough scene. That's not the toughest scene of the season, but that was a tough scene.
Yeah.
And then he gets Prax. What a story, right? Then Prax gets dumped, and he's still sort of mourning his daughter / hopeful that maybe she's still alive because he doesn't know for sure. He ends up running into the Rosinante crew, and they pick him up basically because he's a clue to what happened on Ganymede, because has a tie to this guy who turns out to be his daughter's doctor at the clinic.
And that's the tie. I love how he kind of bounces off the crew of the Rosinante, where like he's not just like, yeah, we're all part of the same mission now, and we're all agreed. Like he argues with them about stuff, and it's fun. And I kind of like how Amos kind of like almost kind of adopts him at points, and I don't know. Amos was really fun this season. He's really growing on me as a character I previously did not care about at all. So
much like Aaron Wright, I also feel like Prax has a lot more agency. Of course, in the books, he spends like a lot of time just in a bunk, sedated. So that wouldn't make for good TV. But I like Prax, and Tony, as you were saying, you like Amos a little bit better this season. I like them all better. I'm finally starting to get to a point where I can think of the TV show as separate from the books, even though I've brought up the books a couple of times. Like they feel like separate entities to me now more. So in season 3, if they keep it up, I really anticipate myself saying, well, in the books, a lot less than I have been to date. I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah. I will say, though, that up until the halfway point of the season, I still had mostly season 1 vibes about all of these characters. And
agreed.
then when we get to Pyre and the point where things start accelerating a little in the plot and the story mechanics move forwards, then that's when I think more interesting character stuff is revealed, and they work a lot better.
Honestly, ditching Miller kind of helps streamline things, because Miller, in some ways, Miller runs interference on the family, because though he is on the ship and ostensibly sort of a crew member, he's also, he drives a lot of the plot himself, right? Like his search for Julie is like such a big major part of it that you really get like him and Holden like on their little plot lines. And so with his storyline off screen, all the other characters get much more room to breathe, frankly, right? Like there's more air to go around and there's more time to spend with those characters and to build the dynamics between the family without them being driven to follow Miller's plot line.
Well, right, because you've got Miller plot and Rocinante plot kind of occasionally coming together, and now Miller's plot line has moved off screen, and so you don't have to deal with Miller anymore, and you can focus more directly on the Rocinante. I do wonder, I think I mentioned this the last time we talked, what if they had gotten, I think they've said, if they had gotten 13 episodes for their first season instead of 10, they would have tried to get the whole first book done. And then, and I think the shape of the seasons would have been way better.
Yeah. Because you don't have to split them halfway through.
Well, and because this feels like in some ways, like the climax happens halfway through and then you have to do the work of sort of starting up your next set of story arcs, which I've heard from some people and seen some people on Twitter and other places and emails saying about how they felt like the season more sort of ended rather than came to what they expect from a big plot kind of climax at the end of a season. And the reason is because we're only halfway through the second book. That's why. So it's just all kind of misshapen a little bit.
Well, and it's, I wonder if, you know, in some ways it matters less in this era of bingeable television, right? Because when these things end up on the streaming services eventually,
exactly,
where the season ends is academic, really.
Well, that was, we did a letter for the TU Talk Machine, and when somebody wrote in about this, and that was exactly their point, the letter writer was, I suppose it doesn't matter eventually when they have five seasons on Netflix and you just watch them one after another, but right now it matters.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. And you still have, as you pointed out, our last episode, you still have the repair the antenna episode. So.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if that was there when they figured out a new stopping point, if they realized they had to pad to get to their new season one stopping point since they weren't going to be able to fit in the whole book. I don't know.
The one thing I would say, though, is that 2018 is a long gap to end on where we ended before you get to what's happening. And then I have no idea how they're going to run through the events of what happens for the remainder of the book, as well as what they pick from the book after to do for the third season.
Yeah. That's a weird, cause like, where are they? Right. I mean, the stuff that happened with Avasarala comes towards the end of book two, right? Like on the yacht.
Yeah. So, yeah. The timeline's a little bit different. At
the
least
timeline is a little
our
weird.
Perspective. Yeah.
Yeah. And we've seen, and then we have Venus. Oh, that's an interesting subplot that we, again, did not get in the book, is the Venus probe, which I actually kind of really enjoyed, the two guys, the captain and the scientist guy, like bickering at first and arguing, and eventually they sort of become friends and they know each other's lines. I really dug that.
That was a nice little arc for the guys that only got like 15 minutes of scenes.
And then get disassembled.
And then they die. Yeah.
Well, you know, it happens to the best of us.
I turned to Lauren after they got disassembled, and I said, just so you know, that entire storyline with those spaceships around Venus is like two sentences in the book. It's like, yeah, we sent a ship to Venus and it got disassembled. Okay, got it. But they're like, no, characters. Well, we can do this.
That was
we can
fun.
Make it more interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it gives us more.
Yeah.
It gives us more. It gives that scene more gravitas, right? Because we know them. And then all of a sudden, it's like, oh, okay, then, you know.
Yeah. As opposed to just like a news alert in the background, you know, ship on Venus disassembled. Yeah. Check your email for details.
Now it's personal.
Yeah.
Oh, what a horrible dystopia that far in the future, there's still email to check.
There's always email, Jason.
So one of the things that happens, so the Rocinante crew, there's first off, we have the weeping somnambulist, which is weeping somnambulist. No, I'm not going to.
You didn't get through one.
You can't even do somnambulist five times somnambulist. Fast, probably.
Crying sleepwalker. All right.
Partial credit.
So this is, and it comes back around at the end too. So we get this is a story about they're bringing materials to Ganymede as a relief ship. Is that the idea?
Yeah.
I was a little confused about the economics of being a relief ship, for the people that took people from Ganymede and spaced all the people. Like, that didn't make sense to me, unless we're really mean relief workers.
Yeah, well, I think they just hate. There were OPA guys who hated the inner.
I guess so. There's
pay for their air.
But we are going to rescue other people. It felt a little. I mean, I guess you could take it from that. Yeah, the OPA is hard line, and they will take care of their own, and the other people, no. But it. I was like, are they just the meanest relief workers ever? So,
anyway, that episode starts out with a nice head fake, right? That's the episode where we're like, oh no, pirates are taking over this ship, and it's like, no, it's our crew that's taking over this ship. Right? Because they want to find a way into Ganymede without being on the Rosinante. So they're going to commandeer this Weeping Somnambulist and take it down to Ganymede, which is a great plan until they get down to Ganymede and realize that the people on Ganymede are going to do terrible things to the crew and the supplies. And then there's a gunfight, and the husband of the mom and pop spaceship company is fatally wounded, which is very sad. Yeah, I liked that, how tragic and awful that was, and how she was absolutely right to blame them, and yet at the same time they probably would have just been killed. Yep. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Like I can see the whole fury there, but of course we're never going to see the Weeping Somnambulist again. Except it turns out we are, because everything turns right back around and they end up coming back to that ship after the Rosinante's many adventures on Ganymede. So this whole section is they're investigating the whoever this guy is, who's the doctor of Praxis' daughter, and they go try to find the clinic, and there's a chicken guy and there's a monster. And then Holden becomes like Khan in Star Trek 2 and is like, no, we must chase the monster.
And Naomi is like, this is not working out.
I did not care for Holden getting quite so obsessed, but I do think that it leads a nice opportunity for when they go save the Somnambulist later, which is a really great scene and shot, I felt like, you know, with the torpedo going in. Like, they let them set that up as drama, but it's like, wow, I do not recognize this Holden being like super maniacal about this. It seems
kill the monster.
Yeah, he's very Gaston in these scenes.
Yeah, it's a bit much. But wait, Joe, you groaned about the chicken man.
I didn't care for anything
about
that.
Just chicken for goods and services.
No. Chicken-based economy.
It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't seem like a real business you could even have. It doesn't seem like the kind of nutritional diet you should be on.
Joe, let's talk about what a space side hustle looks like, because that's what a space side hustle looks like. It's
chicken.
Yeah.
I think he's like the money ball of space. I think he's discovered that the most valuable thing that you can have on a space station that's under duress
is protein.
Yep. And the cheapest protein that's available, the most available protein anyway, is chicken. And so he's decided, I'm going to, step one, corner the market on chicken. Step two, Step three, profit. And he's working on step one. Okay.
I think his plan is more solid than you guys are giving him credit for. I think his plan is, I'm the last guy with food. I'm just going to sit in my bunker and eat canned chicken.
Until I die.
Ganymede goes crazy around me. I think he's dealing in whatever, but you know, canned chicken is what gets his attention.
He's crazy like a fox.
A hacker fox.
A fox in the chicken house.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. A doomed fox in the chicken house. A fox with no oxygen.
He died doing what he loved, eating chicken.
Eating chicken.
out of can.
Hoarding and eating chicken. The two things that he loved. One of my favorite scenes in this show, and it shows the power of sound effects, is there's the scene where the grenade gets tossed in to where they are on Ganymede, and Amos, quick thinking, just picks up the grenade, opens the door, throws it back out, and closes the door. All right, and you're like, okay, that was very exciting. What's going to happen next? And what happens next is, boom, thump, screams,
murder,
gunfire, more screams, more thumps. I just thought that was a hilariously awful scene. It's like, oh no, what do we do? Like,
right. Well, because and also in that scene because we haven't seen the monster yet, really, yeah. aside from those brief glimpses. You know, it's that classic works better because you're imagining how awful it is.
Also, I think it's kind of the follow up to the slightly earlier scene where they like bust into the room and the bad guys are basically just all sitting there eating dinner,
pizza.
Yeah, and it's you know,
the one weird thing is that they ran out through that door and locked it behind them, and then when they open it to throw the grenade in, they don't lock the door again?
I think that the implication is that they're not, that they are evil scientists, not Amos quality evil mercenaries.
Yeah.
Also, they figured the grenade would like take care of them, right? They didn't need to worry about locking the door on a bunch of corpses.
Yeah.
I guess. I mean, the only one out of, because they were the Pinkerton security guys or whatever their mercenary security company was, sure. Around the table. And then there was the one doctor assistant lady who had been with Dr. What's-His-Face.
Yes.
Evil scientist.
Strickland.
Strickland. Come on. Yeah. He's got a villain name.
No. I meant the lady evil scientist who is the one, because I was going to mention her, Joe, because, you know, why is it, okay, I get you're evil, but when you're dying, why do you just have to be a jerk when you're dying and have your last words be jerky? But she's like totally to the hilt. It's like, there are more monsters out there, jerk. Suck it.
She probably like had that thing done to her brain like that other guy where she's a sociopath now, right? Yeah.
Oh, yeah, maybe.
Remember, they're all... They've been biologically engineered to be jerks, Jason.
Protogen enhanced sociopath scientists. Yeah,
one question about that, though. Since we brought up the Cortazar and the brain thing and mm-hmm. his speech to, well, not speech, but his conversation with Amos, and then Amos disappears and he comes back all sweaty and weird. Are we to believe that he went under that procedure or something because he was acting all funny, or was he just like in intense contemplation about how weird his life is at the time?
I think he is in intense contemplation about was that done to him / what is wrong with him?
Yeah.
I think that's the thing. And I think the suggestion is that Amos is deeply damaged from traumatic things that happened to him in his childhood / adolescence and maybe he would like to think that he is in fact the result of a science experiment, but he is in fact the result of horrible things done to him by people.
Yeah, I think he's concerned about the fact that he's a monster, which by very definition means that he's not the kind of monster that these people are, because they don't care that they're
although
monsters.
We do a lot more with him sort of looking to Naomi and Holden for what to do in a given scenario, right? Yeah. Which I really appreciate, because that is one of the things I love about that character, is he is just aware of himself enough to say, I can't be trusted to make decisions, right? Because, like, you know, we get the one or two scenes where Naomi has to, like, sedate him at one point, right?
Yeah.
And, like, mm-hmm. you know, because he's making what he thinks is the correct sort of decision, like based on the numbers or, you know, based on sort of the facts of it, but it's not the empathetic solution.
Yeah. He gets a reminder that he doesn't get to make decisions.
Right. Well, yeah.
Yeah. And I think what's, again, to everybody's point, what separates him from a brain developmentally sociopathic person and him is that he has that level of awareness where, okay, so yep. I'm not a psychiatrist or a psychologist, but I think that maybe part of being a sociopath is you don't realize that's how you are. You're just manipulating situations for your own gain, but you don't like really recognize what that is. Don't email me. That's probably completely wrong.
Well, there's that famous thing about if you're truly incompetent at something, you think you're competent at it. And that's how I read Amos here.
Yeah.
Is that, you know, if you're he worries enough about being a monster that he's not completely a monster, because he wouldn't care. And he does care, and he really cares, because he knows he's capable of doing terrible things, and that's why he seeks out help from compasses, moral compasses, like Naomi especially. And I think that's an interesting take on that character, that he's their weapon, and he knows he's a weapon, but he wants to be used for the right reasons. He's an interesting character, and the way he's portrayed on the show. What do people think of, I thought what was the most affecting scene of the entire season, which is the scene where Naomi knocks him out and then he he isn't mad at her later because he thought she was making the right moral judgment there, which goes back to the previous point where he wants to just leave when they can take a certain number of people. It's a classic spin on that, or a spin on that classic science fiction story, The Cold Equations. There are a certain number of people they can take off that they have enough oxygen for, take off Ganymede, but they can't take them all out of the dock. And Naomi basically sacrifices herself, and there's the dude out there who's like holding everybody back. And everybody, and they're like, no, we need to let the children on, and you know, we should let them save themselves and all of that. And they rather than killing each other and having the survivors get on the ship, they stand there and line them up and let the younger ones on first.
I liked that, and I think that it shows. I think that it's a really good way to show the Belcher ethos.
Yeah,
where they kind of expect to die. You know, that's kind of written in the contract of going to the Belt and growing up and being born there, is that a lot of people are going to die. There's not a lot of support. They don't have the best medical care, and that's just how it is. The thing that confused me about that scene was then at the end, that big muscly burly guy who got everything rolling was like, no, Naomi, you save yourself, even though he didn't know her. And I thought that was a little bit weird. Why, besides the plot and we need her to continue the story, why did he do that?
I thought it was kind of not exactly guilt, but it was a, once they sort of recognized, like, you know, okay, we're not just going to be out for ourselves, but we're going to, you know, be orderly about this and save the people that we can save. I felt like he kind of, you know, there's sort of like a stand up straighter aspect to it, where he's like, you know what, I was, you know, being selfish for wanting to save myself, and maybe, you know, you were more valuable than me for whatever reason. I don't know. It seemed like a self-sacrificing moment. I was okay with it. It didn't bother me, because I feel like it'd be hard pressed to be like, all right, we line up all these people, we let all the children in first, and now I'm going to go see you later.
I thought of him as like, he's like, maybe he's cousins, but he's totally the opposite, like the inverse of Miller's Belcher sidekick, who just like wants to like hit on ladies and shoot guns and get high. And he's like, no, I'm the big tough guy, and I'm going to get people in lines, and then I'm going to sacrifice myself for the good of the Belt. So, because Naomi will do better things for the Belt than I will.
The one bothersome thing about that was that Naomi was ready to not go, and she was going to sacrifice herself. And then the guy's like, no, you're too important, you go. And then she's like, okay, fine. And it's like, it's sort of turning around to anybody else in the room and being like, okay, well, you have my seat now. Again, all of a sudden her self-sacrifice just flips on a switch. And it's like, oh, well, I'm good now.
You can't, how many times can you like re-self-sacrifice? It's like re-gifting. Like, you can't do that. That's not like, oh, well, then I will take your spot if you mean that. It's, oh, whoa, 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 whoa. You know,
I think we just missed the scene where she designated the terms of her trading her immunity to him, where she said non-transferable.
Yeah, no take backs.
That's right.
So, yeah, Belcher culture is complicated.
Another scene I wanted to mention, which I like just from sort of a impressive point of view, was the scene where Alex decides to fly the Rocinante down to Ganymede using only the gravity from all the moons and slingshotting himself around. I just really enjoyed that, just from like a pure sci-fi aspect, and because I do like Alex. He's also grown on me this season. I feel like they've given him a chance to become a little bit more of a three-dimensional character, who's not just a dude with an accent. Yeah. I like the scenes where he's hanging out in the Rocinante by himself drinking beers.
Yeah, I was a little worried, where it's like, are we just not going to see you for like an episode or two? And it's like, well, you'll get to get drunk and talk to the ship. That'll be something.
Yeah, but I like the scene where he like maps it out with like, he's got the, like the 3D holographic map, and he's like, well, I can go here and here and here. And it's just, it's a fun sequence. And I really enjoyed the way they did that.
Yeah, the producer said that they try to be good with most of the science, but time is the problem, because they want to do a TV show where there's pace and you don't have like months or weeks of travel. And that's an example with him going around the moons of Jupiter. Like, you could totally do that.
It would take a very long time.
Yep. But that's okay. It's TV. It's fine.
Dramatic license.
Yeah, it's fine.
Well, also, when he almost comes around the moon and comes across the other Martian ship, but then backs out of the way just in time and then goes back on course. And it's like, didn't you just kill all of your momentum by doing that?
No, it's all good. It was just minor thrust variations is all he did. He just kind of went to the side and came back, and it's all good. I'm sure that's... Well, yeah. Well, unless he was reversing, if he was, you know, I think I can explain that one away. Here's one of the other climax is there is another protomolecule monster. It's on the Rocinante at the end. There's the whole thing where they have to lure it into space with radiation, or it's gonna tear its way through the hull and into the reactor, or in Holden is pinned against a wall, and all of those things are happening, which I thought was exciting, and it also shows that Prax's complaints and questioning them actually comes to some good, because he figures out the right solution, which is to take a nuclear warhead and like use it as bait and chuck it out into space. I enjoyed that scene. What I didn't enjoy is the end of the previous episode, where we're given a flyby of the Rocinante at the end and ominous music plays. Mm-hmm. And if you look very closely, you might notice something blue, something kind of blue. If you're really paying attention and know what you're looking for, dun, dun, dun. And, you know, that faded out. And Lauren turned to me and said, who hasn't read the books, and said, was there something on the ship or something? And I said, there's supposed to be, but I didn't see it. And I went back and I watched it a few more times, and I still thought it wasn't clear. And this is just one of those ways where occasionally, for all the ambition of the show, occasionally I see something they're doing that technically just seems to be like they just blew
it. I think
it.
I only ran it twice and I got it the second time. Like, I think I rewound the first time and got it on the second viewing, but you're right that it's subtle.
But why not make it clearer? The scene isn't subtle.
Yeah. No, I agree. Yeah.
Or even
it's just the shot.
Not hint at it. You know, could have totally been a surprise at the beginning of the next episode. Just like, oh yeah, there's this thing on the ship, instead of telegraphing that. Because even if you don't see the hint of blue, you still have the music and the, you know something's going to happen, right? So
I will say I like the monster. I think the monster looks pretty cool.
Yeah, I agree.
It's a significant improvement over the shadowy figure that we briefly saw earlier.
Yeah.
It matches up with roughly what I imagined
it would be like gooier.
Yeah, I did too.
Yeah.
I mean, goo costs money though. But
goo ain't cheap, Joe.
Yeah, yeah. You gotta simulate goo.
It's somewhat closer to like the tar monster from Star Trek.
Armus.
We don't see Armus.
Yeah.
Oh, see, I was thinking it's that it's the glowy monster that the DJs from LA are portray in that Star Trek The Next Generation episode. Yes.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
No.
All right. Anyway.
Not a good episode.
Geordi turns into a blue glowy monster.
Oh yeah. And that's the part where we've now sidetracked, but I'm going to say he's in the holodeck and he like does the thing, and there's a shadow cast by someone who's not there. And
they reconstruct the shadow in the
and
holodeck.
It turns out to be a protomolecule monster. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, that is where my childhood fear of reconstructing shadows in the holodeck comes from. So
the thing that I've wondered about both reading the book and watching the show is, and granted the show, as we said, not as gooey as I imagined in the books, but
that's the tagline, Aline, not as gooey as the books.
I'm gonna let that pass. How much bleach do you use to really get rid of this protomolecule, or do you just
enough.
Go at the ship with flamethrowers? Like
spoilers, not enough.
How do you eradicate this once it's been on your vessel? That's what I want to know.
I mean, the cold vacuum of space probably helps, right?
I lived in
the cold vacuum of space.
A little club soda will do wonders.
It turns out. It's a vacuum, just not a problem.
Make sure to dab, not rub at it. That's important.
Okay.
Belter ginger ale is basically just turpentine.
Belter ginger ale is not a drink I would ever order.
Yeah. No. Well, the one weird thing about that
it's
is
just
the level.
It's just recycled water and a punch in the face. That's a Belter ginger ale.
The one weird thing, though, about their level of concern, though, is it varies wildly. Like, in a scene where they first come across the dead child that's inside of the saran wrap in the coffin thing and conveniently placed on top of the incinerator, they're like, no, don't touch it. It's the protomolecule. You can't touch it. It's horrible. And up until this point, touching it is bad. And then they close the door and Holden incinerates it. And then they walk through the door into the next room after that massacre has occurred. And they're just like looking around, everything's fine. Okay, well, I guess we'll put on some suits we found in here and go chasing out after that with Alex. And then it's just like, wait, aren't you concerned about that right now?
I felt like they were occasionally inconsistent about that in the books as well, about like, wait, this thing is like this hyper intelligent life form that can like deconstruct people from the inside out. It goes through the ships in Venus, right? Like it just shows up in the ships, like the little glowy stuff everywhere. And it's like, if it can go through walls, then you're basically screwed, period, because it could probably go through your suit.
Don't chase it down in your ship. Unless you don't like your ship.
You're dead already is my point.
Yeah, well, it's not really that different, especially since in the books there are these vomit zombies that don't really exist in the show, but it's the idea of zombie stories where it's unclear what level of exposure infects you to make you a zombie.
Do you get
and
scratched? The answer do you tends get bitten? To be, do you have to die? Right.
Yeah, I mean, like, in the end, I guess it's whatever the plot requires. It's the speed of plot, as they say, because like The Walking Dead was like that, where it's like, oh no, don't put it on an open wound or cover yourself in zombie goo in order for them not to smell you. It's like whatever works for the moment, and that's all. So that's how I view the protomolecule. It's a little bit like that.
And not to get ahead of ourselves, but it may turn out that they didn't do as good a job of killing it as they thought, right? Or
you could also say, like, the protomolecule, I mean, it seems like, from what we've been shown so far in the show, has a degree of intent, right? So what the protomolecule wants is going to happen.
And it changes and adapts, right? Because the protomolecule, as seen on Eros, is a very different manifestation than the protomolecule as seen in the monster that was genetically engineered by Protogen, or engineered in some way.
Are affecting them in some way. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Exactly. And whatever's happening on Venus is not something we've seen before. So it's entirely possible that whatever protomolecule-laced whatever ended up on Venus is now executing a completely different kind of program or scenario than what the Protogen, you know, monster is doing. We don't really know that. But I agree, there are serious contamination questions.
Wash your hands, people.
With bleach.
Lavese las manos, yeah. Mm-hmm. The Hands of Fate. Oh, no. Wrong show. Mm. What have we not covered that we should cover?
Naomi's betrayal of Holden.
Oh, yeah. That was out there. I totally didn't throw away the protomolecule like you told me to. Instead, I gave it to Fred Johnson.
Yeah, she was holding out on Holden.
Joe made a pun.
Joseph.
I was saving that one for like an hour and a half.
You should have kept
it. Yeah, I kept it for another week. So yeah. Holding it in.
And, you know, it's interesting. I was thinking sort of tangentially related to this that Naomi's, you know, we get Naomi's backstory here, which in the books does not come up for like three more books. Yeah. And they had kind of hinted at
that. That seems like more of a failure of writing in the books, where it's like we forgot to give her a backstory for a couple of books.
100% agree. And I think it's the huge benefit of being able to write this show from that vantage point means you can do that.
Yep. The only way they could have made it more awkward is if, like, she hit her head in book four and it's like, I just remembered I have a backstory this whole time.
I was noting, you know, at a couple different points that they drop hints really early. Like, there is another character is mentioned, a sort of minor character is mentioned off screen at one point as a potential, like, blackmail target or something, who is a character that will probably show up at some point. I like that they laid out Naomi's backstory a little more here. And I kind of like the rationale for Naomi's betrayal here. Like, it does make a certain sort of sense, even if it's morally questionable.
Yeah, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
I get it. She's thinking, we could destroy it and make everybody safe, or we could keep it and keep some, you know, power to right this power imbalance. I mean, it's not that different an argument than the argument that Anderson Dawes makes, right?
Right.
Which is deterrence
too, right?
Like they've given us power. Why would we not keep that? Because they're always trying to get us.
Right. And moreover, you can't uninvent it, right? Like it's out there. You can't destroy all of it. So we need to level the playing field.
Yep.
Right. And in fact, Dawes has already transmitted all the, you know, information about the protomolecule to the belt, right? Despite Fred Johnson's attempts to stop him. So what you going to do? I don't know. That's Holden seems to take it well, but you know, we don't get a lot of time, and then
was like the
season's
last
over.
Thing.
Yeah,
but the you do get the shot of Fred Johnson in a spacesuit,
opening,
pulling it out. So he found their torpedo.
That's how Fred Johnson
felt like,
turns into.
Don't you have people to do this? But I was willing to accept it as like visual shorthand for like, you know, we only want this scene to be 10 seconds, so we're going to show Fred Johnson out there in a spacesuit instead of Fred Johnson getting the memo that the guy in the spacesuit had picked up the thing. So
no, that the third guy had picked it up after the first two guys died, and he'd be like, all right, well, what you got to do?
Just yeah, like, well, don't it's you a have bit... like a space station to rebuild that was almost taken in a coup? Like
maybe Tony feels like there's no one for him to trust.
Yeah,
that's the equivalent of like a character in a play, like pulling a gun out of their pocket and like rubbing it to be like, yes, I have a gun in my pocket, and then putting it back in. It's like, yeah, okay, I guess I get why you had to do that, but nobody would do that.
Well,
come on.
But if he's not telling anyone else, maybe he went out there on a little. Like something like the Razorback. Yeah, so he went out there.
Went on a little yacht.
Yeah, and then was like...
I'm going on vacation. Nowhere special.
if you want me, I'll be in my quarters. Don't call. Yeah.
Just like that.
Anything else
we've
missed?
His assistant was covering for him.
Yeah, his assistant, yeah.
I loved the last scene and the ship breaking apart. It was so cool to watch, I gotta say. And I said, that is so cool. And Justin was like, that is so cool. And I was like, I wonder if Joe's gonna pick that apart when we talk about it.
No, it's already been picked apart.
I thought it was really neat.
No, it was neat. I mean, I didn't want to say anything before when you guys were talking about how much you love the rapport between these two guys, but I thought they were total duds, and I kind of didn't want to spend any time with them at all. But yeah, I mean, they made a pretty death.
Yeah, they got like reverse diagrammed. It looked like an assembly diagram for how to build a spaceship.
It did.
Yeah. Like the protomolecule is just going to take it apart. They didn't take apart the people. I'm sure that's the next step, right? It's just disassemble the people the same way, see what's inside them.
I think there's just shorthand that happens off screen because I don't think anybody really wants to see people flayed on
probably not
on cable.
Well, not yet. Only you got to go to HBO. Yeah,
premium for that. Premium cable, Joe. Premium cable.
Yeah, at least Stars. So.
Burn. All right. Anything else? Overall, season two. How about that? Like, I thought it was a step up from season one. I thought they got their.
I think they're finding
their
footing. Yeah, you took the words out of my space mouth. So yeah.
Yeah, totally agree. I think that they're falling into a rhythm that the cast and crew is kind of starting to really feel more comfortable with one another, and I think that's coming through. And I agree, the second half of the season felt really, really solid. I'm excited for season three and don't really want to wait. I guess I don't have a choice, but I think if they keep it up, it's going to be wonderful, and I'm really excited for that.
Yeah, I agree. I think that they really seem to have found their groove. And I finally, like Aline, I'm finally getting to the point where I can view this as a separate thing without being constantly like, well, that's not how the books did it. And so I am looking forward to the next season quite a bit. And yeah, I guess maybe there'll be another book before there's another season. The guys seem to churn out those books really fast.
I, like you guys, I agree. The second season overall is way better than the first, but in particular, the second half of the second season is way better than either the first half of the second season or either of the halves of the previous season. There's just more happening in the second half of the season than there was up until this point. Things are in motion, and we don't need to pointlessly waste our time on other things that are happening elsewhere. It's just all about protomolecule stuff all the time, and I love it.
Yeah, and there is another novel that's supposed to be coming out this year. They missed their June ship date for the last one, so maybe it'll be in December again like it was, but you know, if all stays on schedule, there'll be another novel.
I still haven't finished the last one.
Of nine. There are so many.
That's right.
So many books.
I keep reading them.
Sci-fi authors are the worst.
I know.
Yeah.
You got to take it, Dan. You got to take it. Enjoy the remaining how many days where you're not one?
Yeah, yeah. And then everybody starts asking about when's the next one?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's happening?
Hey, Dan, it's like when is the next one?
It's like when you get married and they're like, everyone's like, are you going to have kids like at the wedding?
Yep.
See, yeah, everyone's been there.
People are terrible. That's what we're saying. All right. Well, if there's nothing else, then maybe we will wrap up The Expanse for this year for our occasional series, the fourth in the occasional series, talking about season two of The Expanse. Nope. All right. Well, then I'm going to close the door on this podcast.
Wait, no, don't space us.
Only the inners. And by that, I mean Dan and Tony. Dan.
Oh, no.
Dan Morin, thank you.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Tony Sindelar, thank you.
Why am I being pushed into this airlock? Bye.
Close the door, boys.
That is the worst belter accent I've ever heard.
I've heard worse. Joe Rosensteel, thank you.
Thank you.
And Aline Sims, thanks.
I will bring the flamethrower.
Excellent. And put on your power armor.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll be back next year, perhaps, for more discussions of future Expanse television series season, since it's been renewed and is coming back. But until then, thanks for listening to this podcast. I'm Jason Snell. Goodbye.